Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past 30 years, the income and inequality gap has continued to widen in the United States. Income inequality is now greater in the U.S. than in any other Western industrial country. Between 1977 and 2007, 60% of national income went to the richest 1% of Americans. According to UC Berkeley economist Emmanuel Saez, who's done major work on income inequality, it has grown more acute in the last couple of years. In fact, according to data that was released by the Social Security Administration just last week, and this really didn't get much attention in the media, the rich are getting richer. 134 Americans raked in more than $50 million last year. The number of Americans making between $20 million and $50 million also jumped. But then you look at what the average American makes. Last year, it was just over $44,500. Today's guest, Professor Richard Wolff, says that the first step in understanding why this is happening is to grasp a basic truth about modern capitalist economic systems. Richard Wolff is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and founder of Democracy at Work. He hosts a weekly national radio show called Economic Update. It airs in the Bay Area on KPFA. And he's the author of several books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Richard Wolff will be speaking at the Berkeley City Club on Thursday. The reception is at 6. The lecture is at 7. It's a benefit for the Living New Deal Foundation. And you can find information at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Richard. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Rose. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, we are very happy to have you. So since the crash of 2008, so much literature has been produced on inequality, the rise in poverty, the deepening wealth gap in the United States. We had Occupy. Politicians from across the spectrum started using this language. Several books have been written. We've had documentaries. But it seems like, well, the data bear this out. Income inequality and the gap continues to widen. The Social Security Administration just came out with new data last week. Why is this the case?
Well, I think it's a belated recognition here in the United States of something, as you rightly said at the beginning of the program, has in fact been going on now for several decades. We didn't want to face it. We played the old denial game. And so the country kept going in that direction until it reached a kind of crisis point. Part of the reason, it's a complex story, but part of the reason the economy crashed in 2008 and that most Americans are still in an unrecovered set of economic problems is fundamentally because we are an economy that, for a while, really had a middle class, where the production of the stores and the offices and the factories was geared to the notion that the average American, never, of course, all Americans, but the average American was in a situation to earn higher income and buy more stuff and therefore provide the jobs for others in a kind of nice upward spiral. In the 1970s, that stopped. American businesses didn't want to pay the rising wages that they used to pay. They moved production, particularly out of the United States, all over the world, and took advantage of the cheaper wages in other parts of the world, letting the United States become the second choice, the place where you didn't produce anymore, the place where the jobs either weren't going to be there or they were going to be much more poorly paid, with fewer benefits, all of the rest of it. And when you do that, when you allow your private businesses to leave the country to make more profit someplace else, you set in motion a train of events which show up as a widening gap between rich and poor. And unless you're willing to step in a dramatic way to change the way the economy works, this is a self-reinforcing process, which is why the numbers you quote are those numbers, namely that even after we start recognizing how severe it is, how deep the inequality has been allowed to go, we still seem like the proverbial deer in the headlights, unable to intervene to change this.
Do you think that people understand how capitalism really works, because during the crash, we did so many shows about this. I mean, even people on CNBC were having conversations about capitalism. Richard Reich is out with a new book called Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few. And you argue that in order to really understand what we are dealing with, we have to grasp a basic truth about modern capitalism. But do you think people actually understand how it works?
No, I don't think the American people have been given a fair shake in what you need to do, which is to have a public national discussion about our economic system, capitalism. To do that in an honest, straightforward way, which is to do for the economic system what we as Americans take pride in doing for other systems. Let me explain briefly. We debate our education and school systems. We debate our health system. We have the last few years done that. We even debate such basic institutions as marriage and what it means. But when it comes to debating the economic system, we get an F. We haven't done that. We haven't done it for half a century, 50 years, because of the Cold War. And even now that the Cold War is behind us, it was impossible to talk honestly about capitalism. Whenever the topic came up, which was rare, your job as a quote-unquote loyal American was to be basically a cheerleader. We were all supposed to think and believe that capitalism is the only system, the best system, etc., etc. And if you didn't say that, people looked at you as if there was something perhaps a little screwy about you or dangerous about you. And so we didn't. We gave that system a pass. We didn't subject it to the criticisms of a public debate the way we did with education or transportation or energy or our health insurance and so on. And you know, if you don't subject a basic system in your society to public debate, scrutiny, well, then you don't notice its failures, you don't face them, you don't struggle over how to overcome them, and so you let the system rot, if you allow me the words. I think we're in economic difficulty, as bad as we are, in good part because for 50 years it was taboo in America to talk honestly about the pros and cons of capitalism. One of cons, by the way, being the generation of inequality of the sort we've been discussing. And then to look at alternatives. What are they and where can you do it? I don't want to leave people with a bad feeling about it. I think we're coming out of this 50-year taboo. And I would use as an example the debate the other night, the Democratic Party presidential debate, in which you had two signs of the breaking down of the taboo. Mm. On the side of Mr. Sanders, there's the fact that for the first time in at least half a century, a person who takes the label socialist is listened to and taken seriously as a candidate, whether you like him or not. The fact that he's a socialist doesn't rule him out of the conversation. And likewise, and in fact, even more important, Mrs. Clinton, at a key point in that debate, says to the public, I'm quoting now pretty nearly her exact words, "Sometimes you have to save capitalism from itself." Well, there's an admission that we have a system that it's in deep trouble if a leading candidate has to talk about saving it from itself, whatever exactly that means. I think we are emerging from a self-induced taboo about a system which we now have to face is delivering, whatever else it does, some very bad, divisive gaps between rich and poor that are corrupting our society in fundamental ways.
Well, we were doing a Google News search on socialism and capitalism, and Bernie Sanders comes up on almost every search. Alternet just released a poll. Actually, it's a YouGov poll that Alternet wrote about, showing that more Democrats now favor socialism than capitalism. And during that debate, a lot of people were talking about the fact that citizens were looking up socialism and they were reading more about what it actually means.
Yeah, I think it's catch-up time. You know, if you go to any single European country, any one of them, and indeed this is true for most countries around the world, There are socialist parties and communist parties and right-wing parties, and the citizens grow up, go to school, become aware of their environments, and they know about socialism and communism. They like it, they don't like it, but it's part of their culture. We don't have that. It was so necessary in the Cold War era to be anti-communist and anti-socialist that it went to the point not just of being critical, which is of course fine, but to the point of excluding it. Universities don't teach courses about that subject. They will occasionally have a teacher dismiss the subject. That's not a serious way of dealing with it. So I'm not at all surprised that Americans, now that they realize that capitalism has got some serious problems, and now that it becomes interesting to look at what the alternatives might be, are discovering, as people have for 150 years, that the most developed collection of theories and actual experiences trying to go in another direction is the tradition we call socialism, and a serious person who wants to deal with the problems of our society is going to have to deal with that and not pretend, the way we did as a country, that it's just so terribly evil and silly that we don't have to pay any attention.
What are your thoughts on the steps the very elite and the ruling class will take to rein in this system, to rein in capitalism? Because you even have the Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen admitting that this is now a major, major problem. She said, quote, "The past few decades of widening inequality can be summed up as significant income and wealth gains for those at the very top and stagnant living standards for the majority." So what are your thoughts on the steps they're going to take to deal with this issue?
Well, to be very honest, and in the hopes that that will be appreciated, I like what Janet Yellen said. She and I were classmates at Yale University years ago, learning economics. I know she's genuine in her concern, as are people like Warren Buffett, one of the richest people on earth, who says pretty much the same thing. The evidence shows that these concerns remain the concerns of a small number of people, and either they are unable or they are unwilling. I have no way for me to tell. But to make those real, that's why the numbers right through to today, in terms of what the Social Security Administration points out, is that we have a group of people at the top who are unconcerned as a group. Of course, there are exceptions, but are in general unconcerned and are pushing ahead with a widening gap between rich and poor as if there's nothing to worry about, as if there are no social consequences of all of this. I think they're making a tragic mistake, one that is so serious for our country that they themselves will before long regret. And this, by the way, is what Warren Buffett himself has said. They will regret having been as unconcerned about this problem as they remain, because they may be digging their own hypothetical graves here, because in the end, especially in a country like the United States, which celebrated for so long the so-called middle class that most of us thought we were in such a society, to suddenly show the mass of those folks who thought they were in the middle class that they're not, that there's a group of people at the top with their millions and millions, and you have an increasing problem. You have too much credit card debt. You owe too much on your house. You can't send your kids to college unless they come out with a level of debt they will never be able to outgrow. At that point, you run the risk of people feeling fundamentally betrayed by an economic system. And of course, then it's no surprise that they will look at socialism and other isms, because they're beginning to wonder about a society that would treat them the way they feel their lives are now going.
Richard Wolff is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, founder of Democracy at Work, host of the weekly national radio show Economic Update, and author of several books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. He'll be speaking at the Berkeley City Club on Thursday. The reception's at 6, lectures at 7. It's a benefit for the Living New Deal Foundation. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for Richard Wolff about inequality, stagnant wages, and capitalism, capitalism, and then alternative solutions. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Richard, when you were talking about the fact that, say, a Warren Buffett and a Janet Yellen are a small percentage of elites who really care about this issue. A new study just came out in Science magazine, and these two researchers measured attitudes of the very wealthy and found that regardless of the party, the elite donors whose money dominates politics and the elite office holders whose decisions set policy do not value economic inequality or equality. And Slate had this piece. It's called Why Income Inequality Isn't Going Anywhere. Rich elites, even rich liberal elites, do not believe in redistributing wealth.
You know, the irony is when I hear that, and I understand what they're saying, and it is the same experience that I have, excuse me, because I also sometimes address groups of wealthy people, and I can see that they kind of fundamentally don't care. But it's inaccurate to say that they're not concerned with redistribution, because over the last 30 years, the redistribution of wealth is exactly what we have had. We have redistributed wealth from the middle and from the bottom to the top. That's what a growing gap between rich and poor means, literally and mathematically. So the irony is, not only has the top grabbed most of the wealth for the last 30 years that we've developed as a nation, but they have made it taboo to discuss the redistribution of wealth, because they don't want people to recognize that that's what's been going on, that the mass of people have come out on the short end of that redistribution, but they don't want that discussed. So the whole question of redistribution is rendered evil or badly intended or somehow out of order. The truth is, to talk now about the gap between rich and poor is to try to do something to undo, to reverse the gross redistribution of wealth that has happened. And I think the warning to the wealthy is a little bit like what Franklin Roosevelt said to them back in the 30s, the last time capitalism collapsed around us, which is, you better give up some of your wealth, because the alternative is a social cataclysm and you won't have any wealth to give up.
We have an email from Art in San Francisco. If you were an advisor to Bernie Sanders after he is elected president, what would you advise him to do in his first 100 days in regard to his economic agenda?
Well, for me, that's quite easy. I'd pick up on something that Mr. Sanders has in his program. He says, I don't remember which number it was in the planks of the economic program, that he is strongly in favor of worker co-ops, of establishing more businesses in the United States and having the government help working people who want to be their own bosses, which Lord knows most Americans do, to set up cooperative enterprises where the workers together in a democratic way make the basic decisions. They decide as a group what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits that, after all, they all contribute to. And let me tell you why that would be my top priority if I were Bernie Sanders' advisor. And it goes directly to the topic of this program. It's the best way, and it may now be the only way, to do something about the inequality of income. Because the fundamental cause, the fundamental source of the growing inequality in America is how we divide the profits from the corner store to the office to the factory to the farm. The key issue that makes us more and more unequal is that the bulk of the profits that are made in enterprises is taken by and given to a tiny group of people at the top, the major shareholders of the businesses and the top executives, the CEOs, and so on. And the reason those folks get the lion's share of the profits, and let me remind everyone, the profits in an enterprise are the result of what everyone does. The CEO, the secretary, the online factory worker, the bus driver, and so on. Everybody contributes to the profits, but a tiny group of people at the top, the board of directors, the big shareholders, they decide what to do with the profits. And to no one's surprise, they mostly give those profits to themselves and thereby become much wealthier, and everybody else is in trouble. If you want to change that, we don't need another law or another regulation. What we need is that we don't want to redistribute the wealth. We want to distribute it fairly in the first place. And if workers together distributed the profits, they wouldn't do it in the unequal way that we now take for granted.
Richard, are you familiar with the piece that Paul Theroux wrote for the New York Times? It's getting a lot of attention, called The Hypocrisy of Helping the Poor. He wrote about exactly what you're talking about. He's taken a road trip to the Deep South, and he went to Hollandale, right, Mississippi, where the entire tax base of the community is 3,500 people, less than $300,000, which is what the chief executive of Apple, Tim Cook, earns in a couple of days. And he said that people like Tim Cook should not be celebrated for giving away all their wealth to, you know, to deal with inequality. They should bring back all of their products to the United States and open up factories here in the U.S., and that would do much better to help people. He's getting so much attention for this story.
Absolutely, because we've tried that. We have tried endless laws, endless regulation, endless moral appeals. It doesn't work. You know, last year, the United States was a place, among other countries, where a book was celebrated in an unusual way. It was written by a French economist, Thomas Piketty, who, by the way, works with Emmanuel Saez, who you quoted earlier in the program. They're very famous for being the greatest authorities on distribution of wealth and income. Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, documents how capitalism, wherever it has become the dominant system, from England in the 18th century throughout the 19th and 20th as it spread around the world, it has produced greater inequality. Periodically, people have been so angry about it that they've risen up and made changes that slowed or reversed the process for a while, only to see the basic logic of capitalism revive and reinstitute the widening gap between rich and poor. So we know that capitalism is the problem, and to try to fix it around the edges with redistributive rules and regulations not only doesn't work, it also puts the country at its, you know, divides us from one another, makes us angry. And it's not hard to see why. If you give someone an income and then you decide to take it away in the name of redistribution, you're going to have an unhappy camper. Much better would be, don't distribute it unequally in the first place. And the way to do that is, and that's why I see that article about his trip to Mississippi moving in this direction, do it properly in the first place, so we don't fight with each other about redistributing it. And the way to do that is to put it in the hands of everybody. I hate to be sloganeering, but let me say it this way. If you want the economy to really serve the people, you got to put the people in charge. And if you don't do that, if you don't make the workplace democratic, if you don't make it a place where we together decide democratically what we want, including how we want to divide the rewards of work, well, then you can't be surprised that leaving it in the hands of a few enriches them at everybody else's expense.
And the end of this piece by Paul Theroux says that bringing back factories is a major solution. If this modest proposal seems an outrageous suggestion to make products for Nike, Apple, Microsoft, and others in the Deep South, it's only because the American workers would have to be paid fairly. Perhaps some CEOs won't end up multi-billionaires as a result, but neither will they have to provide charity to lift Americans out of poverty. And today we are talking with Richard Wolff about the economy, inequality, capitalism, and solutions to all of these problems we're facing today. Richard Wolff is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He'll be speaking at the Berkeley Club on Thursday, reception at 6, lecture at 7. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. And we've got full lines. We'd love to hear from you on these issues, and we will take your calls after this break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Again, it's a toll-free call. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We'd like to hear from new voices. Right now, though, our lines are all full, so maybe you'd prefer to send an email. Send your question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with artists about the Oakland Museum's Day of the Dead exhibition, Rituals and Remembrance. It explores how various cultures view death, memory, and healing. So how do you remember your ancestors? I hope you can join us tomorrow for that. Coming up on Wednesday, we will talk about what's on the San Francisco ballot. We have 11 propositions, very important ones that will affect San Francisco, but other Bay Area cities are also watching closely. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation about renewables and a plan to keep oil and gas in the ground in California. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Richard Wolff, a Marxist economist and professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He hosts a weekly radio show, Economic Update, and he's author of Democracy at Work. He'll be speaking at the Berkeley City Club on Thursday. It's a benefit for the Living New Deal. The reception's at 6, lectures at 7. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we have full line, so let's hear from Molly in Carmel. Hi, Molly. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much. I realize in listening to you in this really interesting discussion that my little list of proposed regulations is just adds more to the list of regulations, but if everyone were to pay into Social Security, just whatever their income, if carbon use was taxed, and if jobs which are given to machines still have to be paid, still have to pay into the Social Security fund, those are a variety of the ideas, and I'm appreciate so much your thinking.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad you raised that because, Richard, 60 million people on Social Security will not receive any cost of living increase next year and probably also not in 2017. Now, this has been getting a lot of attention. What doesn't get included in these stories is that the average monthly Social Security benefit is about $1,100 a month, and so many people rely on this for their sole source of income.
Yes, and I think Molly raises a really interesting list of things, and I'd like to comment on the very first one she mentioned, because it's amazing how many people don't know this. She points out quite correctly that our Social Security system is absolutely bizarre. First of all, we all pay the same percentage of our income. There's no graduation the way we do with our income tax, where if you earn more, the idea is you're better able to pay, so you pay a higher percentage. We don't do that. It's a flat rate, the same rate for everybody. But even more amazing is you only have your money taken away in your flat rate out of your salary up to about $120,000 this year. So if you earn more than $120,000, let's say you earn $220,000 a year, so you're really wealthy, you only pay your Social Security, like everybody else, on the first 120, and then the next 100, you don't pay any Social Security tax at all. This is an arrangement which means that the government doesn't get the Social Security money it needs, and which, if it got it, it could give people an increase over that low amount that you quoted. But it also means that the government not only doesn't have the money to help everybody, but does it because it won't tax those most able to pay. It is outrageous. And when you think about it, it forces you to ask the fundamental question, which is, how's that possible? And the answer is, one of the things wealthy people do after they become really wealthy, it's the same with large corporations, is they know that sooner or later the unfairness of it all will get out, and that therefore they need to control the political system so that it doesn't pass the rules and regulations of the sort Molly's list perfectly illustrates. And so they capture the political system in all the ways that we know of and see every day. And that's understandable because they have to control the political system to keep in place the very kinds of crazy rules like that Social Security arrangement, which allows the wealthiest people to have the largest chunk of their income escape the Social Security tax because of how it's handled.
Right. And for the record, this is not controversial because according to the National Academy of Social Insurance, 71% of Republicans, 92% of Democrats believe that the cap should be raised.
Absolutely. And that shows you how powerful the folks at the top are,
right,
that they can control a political system to make sure it doesn't do even what a vast majority of people would, if given half a chance, make the law.
Well, thank you for calling in, Molly. And let's go next to Joe in San Francisco. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I wanted to make the point that you brought up the dichotomy of socialism versus capitalism as being a kind of main issue in right now. And I just wanted to point out that, Social Security and, everyone gets Medicare, free health care basically once they turn 67, public education, we are socialists. I mean, like a country like Germany might have a higher degree of socialism, or Japan, and some countries like Chile might have a lower degree of socialism. But it's not. They're all capitalists. I mean, they're all capitalists. They're not communists. It's not like a state planned economy where all the carpenters work, for the central government and are given their work orders every morning. I don't think it's just how much socialism. I mean, do we want more? Do we want less?
Right. Right. And this is what Bernie Sanders is talking about, Richard.
Yeah, I think so. But I think that we have to become aware that one of the costs of not having it possible to really talk about socialism and communism and capitalism over the last 50 years, to have an honest, reasonable debate about the pros and cons of all of these things. One of the results of that is we're not very well up to date, let's call it, with what has happened to socialism and communism and all those ideas. They haven't stood still. For example, nowadays, the people most interested in socialism are talking not about the government doing more or less. That used to be what the conversation was. Here's what the focus today is. It's about how you organize, not the government, but how you organize the enterprise itself, the factory, the office, the store. And the central idea is that what socialism means is to finally bring the mass of people who do the work into the position of making the decisions. That's why the phrase democratize the enterprise has become the new watchword of what socialism is. So that capitalism is the old way of running a business. A few people at the top, maybe those who started it, maybe those who became members of the board of directors, they make all the decisions. Everybody else is told what to do, how to do it, where to do it, and told to go home at the end of the day because the folks at the top will decide what to do with the output. Socialism is now becoming the demand for something different, namely that the democracy, which here in America is something we all give lip service to, but that if we really mean it, that democracy is the best way, then the place we ought to have instituted it from the very beginning is the workplace. Not just in the neighborhood where we live, not just in our politics, but in the workplace, which is where we go 5 out of 7 days for the best hours of the day. If you believe in democracy, then that's what ought to be in the place where you spend most of your adult life. And that means, to be real clear, that the workers together, one person, one vote, decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. And that would be the kind of change that now motivates people who are looking for an alternative to a capitalism that produces an inequality that is becoming unbearable.
Well, thank you for calling in, Joe. Let's go next to Ede in Berkeley, I believe. Hi, Ede. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. You know, being a small business owner, which was ruined by exactly what Richard's talking about, I felt it all along. And even though today the United States is richer than ever, you see how much poverty, how much inequality. The fact is 25% bottom Americans, their net worth is under $10, under $10. You know, I saw it from the beginning in the 80s when I had the big store. They start shipping factories overseas. All of the consumer electronic brands like RCA, Zenas, and Magnavox were thrown out in the garbage can. Mm. Then after that, they throw all of the jobs overseas. You had to call somebody in India or Philippines to talk to a credit card, insurance company, whatever. And after that, they bring H1, H2 visa, replace a lot of very highly paid technical people from Silicon Valley, who was, you know, mostly people from East India, paying one-fourth or one-fifth of the salary. So it is down, down, down. I'd like to end it by saying, Apple Corporation, please everybody stop buying their product. Their product are price fixed, three times as much as value. They also have slave labor in China making the product. When Obama was in the Bay Area a few years ago, he asked Steve Jobs if he can bring some of the jobs back to the United States. Steve Jobs told him, Mr. President, these jobs will never come back. Everybody wake up. You've been screwed by all of these companies, and we are down, 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 hell. We're heading for a crash. Whether the banks are not loaning money to small businesses anymore. There's hardly any small businesses left in the whole United States. The small businesses are the backbone of the middle class.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ede, and you might want to check out the piece that I referenced earlier called The Hypocrisy of Helping the Poor. And Richard, Ede calls in when we do shows about the economy because he owns an electronics store in Berkeley, and he's been hit really hard because of trade deals.
Right. We're in the midst of trade deals. They're a wonderful example of what we've already been talking about. The TPP, which is the trade deal for the Pacific, and the TTIP, which is the trade deal for the Atlantic. In those deals, which are stunning in part because they've been conducted now for many, many months in secret. It's as if the big corporations and the governments that they're working with to cut a new set of rules for international trade are so aware of what the mass of people would believe and be outraged about if they knew what was being planned, that they have to do it in secret. And they're really arranging not only for the secret deals to be worked out, but for what's called fast-track authority, so they can rush them through the Congress and the parliaments of other countries to get them all into the law before kind of anyone wakes up and realizes that these are deals cut for corporations to make more money, to make deals with the politicians they already own in order to rewrite the rules for the number one purpose of making more money. That's the bottom line mentality that has governed our economy and is producing the very problems. And if we permit it, which we are doing as a nation, then we're going to get more of the same. And Mr. Warren Buffett and Janet Yellen and others will be bemoaning the deepening inequality of this country until literally it blows up. I think Ede is basically right to be as agitated as he clearly is.
Richard Wolff is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, host of the national weekly radio show Economic Update, author of several books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. He'll be speaking at the Berkeley City Club on Thursday. It's a benefit for the Living New Deal. Receptions at 6, lectures at 7. Find information at yourcallradio.org. And if you have a question or a comment for Richard Wolff about the economy, inequality, capitalism, solutions. Do you think that the conversation is changing with Bernie Sanders in the race talking about these issues? What are your thoughts on that? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Do you think that people do understand how this capitalist system works? I knew that Bernie Sanders was going to ask, why would anyone elect a socialist? I think it'd be interesting if people asked the Republicans, why would anyone elect a capitalist, and for them to define capitalism. What are your thoughts on that? 866-798-8255. Email is feedback at yourcallradio.org. Richard, would you talk a little bit about the kind of capitalism that we have today, especially when you look at multinationals and global capitalism? How is that affecting wealth inequality and just what we're seeing, you know, the gap between the rich and the poor?
Well, I think the basic euphemism of our time is this word globalization. It's a way of putting a very nice dress on a very sketchy human being. Globalization refers really to the movement of businesses out of Western Europe, North America, and Japan into parts of the world where fundamentally labor is much, much cheaper. Places like China, India, Brazil, and so on. There's nothing mysterious about it. There's nothing mystical about it. Corporations had a kind of unique eureka moment, you might say, in the 1970s, when they realized that they were paying high wages that had been won by workers' struggles in the United States, Europe, and Japan. That's why the standard of living in those countries was higher than in the rest of the world. And with the development in the 1970s of the jet engine that allows you to get anywhere in the world in a few hours, and the modern internet and telecommunications, which meant that a company based in New York or Chicago or San Francisco could watch what's going on in the factory floor 10,000 miles away as easily as they used to watch what happened across the street, it then had this eureka moment where the corporation says, why in the world are we here in the United States or Britain or France or Japan paying X dollars an hour when we can pay that many cents an hour in these other countries? I mean, my attention was caught the other day by a march in Dhaka in Bangladesh, where hundreds of thousands of people were marching to get the minimum wage there raised to $100 a month. How are the United States going to compete with $100 a month? The answer is we're not. And if we don't stop them, corporations will continue to leave. And, you know, this ought to be part of an understanding. Let me use the example of Detroit. In the 1960s, Detroit was the model capitalism of the United States. Presidents brought visitors from around the world to Detroit. There were workers who earned a good living. They were members of a strong union, the UAW. It was a thriving city. Not only was it the motor city of the world, but it produced the Motor City Sound, a whole new kind of music that has shaped the music of the world. It was a cultural center. 2 million people. That was the population. Here we are, 2015. Detroit's population today is 700,000 people. The majority of people in Detroit were driven out of the city. It has become a poor city. It is the largest urban bankruptcy in the history of the United States. It's a city that's bankrupt. The people were forced out, ripped out from their families, their churches, their neighborhoods, etc. It is a disaster. It's been unfolding for 30, 40 years. And every mayor of the city, every governor of Michigan, and every president has stood there, watched this happen. Watch it, by the way, happen to other cities like Cleveland, like Camden, New Jersey, Youngstown, Ohio, where I was born. These are wastelands of a capitalism that has been showing us now what it has in store for us. And I think the American people are finally realizing you better do something fundamental. Otherwise, this kind of destruction by the system as it moves on bodes very poorly for the future of all Americans.
Do you think that the TPP will ultimately pass? Because as you're talking about outsourcing, the TPP, if it does go through, will allow corporations to move their shops to Vietnam, where people make between 48 and 69 cents an hour. And they want to do that because a lot of workers in China and other countries are rising up saying, we don't want these slave wages anymore.
Yes, my fear is we're watching the struggle between one group of corporations and another, and that's what will determine whether TPP passes. This is a game in which the companies with the most clout write the rules for themselves, but that hurts other companies. Let me give you an example. If a company in the United States, a big one, and I won't pick a particular one because it really doesn't matter, but a big company in America wants the rules written such and such so it makes them more money. Okay, that's very nice, but that upsets a company in another country. But they're willing to go along if they get the rule written for themselves in another way that helps them. But that upsets yet another company. So what you end up having is some companies win, they get the rules rewritten the way they want, they become the big supporters of TPP, but other companies announce within an hour that, I don't like this set of rules. This is not good for me. For example, the Ford Motor Company announced within hours of Obama's statement that we have reached a tentative agreement on TPP that they were dead set against it. Ford didn't get what it wanted. GM might have, or Toyota might have. And so what we're going to be watching is, we the people, a struggle among groups of corporations that will make sure that what either TPP passes or some amended version passes, it'll be good for the corporations who win that struggle, and we will live with the results, which may very well include, for example, the very movement to the Vietnam cheap labor situation that you identified. What we're doing as a nation is allowing something as central as the rules of international trade, at a time when the American economy is more dependent on international trade than has been the case for 200 years, we're allowing those decisions that we'll all live with to be decided by a tiny group of corporations, the politicians they put in office, with their negotiations about this done in secret. This is not a behavior of a nation of people. This is a behavior of a nation of sheep.
Richard Wolff is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He'll be speaking at the Berkeley City Club, a benefit for the Living New Deal, on Thursday. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. In our remaining few minutes, Richard, let's talk a little bit about solutions. And I wanted to talk about a very important Princeton study that came out last year that I think deserves so much more attention. It used data from over 1,800 different policy initiatives from 1981 to 2002 and concludes that rich, well-connected individuals now steer the direction of the country, regardless of or even against the will of the majority. So we talked about how the majority believe in raising the cap on Social Security. 68% right. of Americans believe taxes should be raised on the wealthy. 63% support a $15 minimum wage. I mean, there's just so much of this data that we have out there about what the people believe, and what the politicians do is the complete opposite. So if a study like this comes out from Princeton that says the U.S. is no longer a democracy because the leaders are not listening to the people, where do you begin at that point?
Well, again, I don't mean to beat the proverbial dead horse here, but if you allow the wealth to accumulate in the hands of big corporations and the top 1%, you really can't be surprised that those folks are smart enough to know that sooner or later the mass of people, using the right of universal suffrage, the fact that the mass of people are the overwhelming majority, sooner or later they're going to decide it's time to use their political power, one person, one vote, to undo the inequality created by a capitalist economic system. And so the rich, to preserve their wealth, the corporations to preserve the profits that they focus on, have to corrupt the political system. They have to make it work so it's dependent on them and not listening to what the majority of people want. That's been the age-old argument of socialists, that there's a fundamental structural contradiction between capitalism and the way it evolves and the principle of democracy. And nowhere is that more clear than in the internal workings of capitalist enterprises, where democracy is left at the front door with your coat when you go into work, because once you enter the workplace, you don't have the democratic right to make the decisions. You're at the beck and call of a tiny number of people who have the decision-making power and who make the system work for them. If we don't want it to work for the few and we don't want them to corrupt our politics, then we can't leave them in the position sitting atop the economic pyramid the way they have and continue to do.
So it seems like it goes back to really Citizens United and civic participation, because the New York Times had a piece last week saying that 158 families are giving the majority of the money, mostly to Republicans, and then million-dollar donations are going to Hillary Clinton.
Right. And nor is that very surprising. The only really surprising thing, which I know has surprised everybody, is that Mr. Sanders' campaign, by being able to raise millions and millions of dollars in a way none of us thought he could, is raising them from the mass of people, and once again thereby demonstrating that, yes, the rich will do what they do to protect their situation. No surprise there. What is perhaps surprising, particularly here in America, is that given the current conditions, millions of little people are coming up with the $10 and $20 and $30 that make Mr. Bernie Sanders' campaign the phenomena that it has become, and that this may be the most important lesson, whatever the outcome of the actual election. The lesson here is that capitalism has moved from the self-satisfied, self-confident, we're the best thing since sliced bread, on over to something that a socialist can contest, that the mass of people want to fund, and that the presumptive leading candidate on the Democratic Party, Mrs. Clinton, has to say in a public debate, sometimes we have to save capitalism from itself. That is a sea change in the direction and in the spirit and the atmosphere of American politics.
And final thoughts, Richard Wolff. Noam Chomsky was interviewed recently and said he fears that the momentum that Bernie Sanders has started will dissipate after the election is over. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's that Noam Chomsky is right. Not so much in what he thinks is going to happen, but in pinpointing a very crucial question. Mr. Sanders has an unbelievable historical opportunity. He's broken through. He's made socialism okay as a part of the American political dialogue, the way it is in every other country, finally after 50 years of taboo. And now the question is, can you keep this momentum going? So it's not a question of what will happen. It's really a question of whether Mr. Sanders will show the historic leadership that no matter what happens in the voting, will he transform the excitement and enthusiasm he's generated now into an ongoing organization that can draw into itself the extraordinary energies and commitments that have already fueled his campaign. If he does that, if he builds a lasting organization, his legacy will be far more important than anything about this particular election.
Richard Wolff is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He'll be speaking at the Berkeley City Club on Thursday. It's a benefit for the Living New Deal. Find information at yourcallradio.org. Richard, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with artists about the 21st annual Oakland Museum's Day of the Dead exhibition, Rituals and Remembrance. It explores how Latin American, Filipino, Hawaiian, African American, and others view death, memory, and healing. How do different cultures honor their ancestors? How do you remember yours? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihei Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.